Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Now, there are little decisions to make in life, like what to wear to work and what to eat for lunch. Then there are potentially life-changing decisions, like whether to move, take a new job, break up with someone, or get married. With these big decisions, you may never face the choice before, have to sacrifice one path to choose another, and have a hard time figuring out the right way to go. As a result of the high stakes and high uncertainty, we often flounder in this kind of decision-making, sometimes failing to make any decision at all. My guests have studied those who have to make these kinds of critical choices more often, first responders and members of the military, to figure out how civilians can make better decisions in their everyday lives. Their names are Lawrence Allison and Neil Shortland, and they're the authors of Decision Time, How to Make the Choices Your Life Depends On. Today on the show, Lawrence and Neil explain the mistakes people commonly fall into when making big decisions, including getting stuck in a cycle of redundant deliberation where you forever circle around the options without ever pulling the trigger on one. They then unpack their model for more effective decision-making, including why it should follow a foxtrot pattern, and how to know when it's time to stop ruminating and finally make a choice. Along the way, we discuss the importance of self-awareness in the process and what it is you need to know about yourself to make better decisions. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/decisiontime. All right. Well, Lawrence Allison, welcome back to the show. Neil Shortland, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us again.
So Lawrence, we've had you on the podcast in the past to discuss two very different topics. The first time we had you on, we discussed what you've learned about building social rapport from being an expert in criminal interrogation. And then the second time, we talked about what we can learn about life from the mythical labors of Hercules. You got a new book out that you've co-authored with Neil. It's called Decision Time. It's all about decision-making. So let's start off with a bit of your respective backgrounds. Let's start with you, Lawrence. Some listeners may already be familiar with you, but can you give us a little bit of review on your background? And then Neil, what's your background and how did you two wind up working together on this book?
Yeah, so I'm a psychologist. Broadly speaking, a forensic, but also do a lot of organizational psychology. As you said, Brett, you very kindly had us on before to talk about rapport. And my other area of interest is decision making. So, I mean, in brief, I deal with things that include difficult communication and difficult decisions. Been doing that for the last 30 years, and that's me.
Neil?
Thank you. So not to age Lawrence, but I was actually a student of his in 2011 on the master's program in Liverpool, in which, you know, I was briefly introduced to some of the research and the ideas around how I think real people make decisions in the real world. And then for me, I actually ended up moving off and working with the UK Armed Forces and then moving to America and studying kind of security psychology. But throughout all of it, I kind of kept this real interest in a paper Lawrence wrote in 2012 about kind of what police decision-making looked like in these kind of, you know, fast-moving counterterrorism operations. And so I went back to Lawrence a couple of years later and kind of had this idea of, well, you know, what if we look at this extreme decision-making psychology, but let's add in this kind of military interest and angle that I'd kind of picked up along the way. So for the next, you know, five or six years, you know, we kind of worked with the army over here and the army in the UK and lots of different agencies studying the real human process of making, you know, really difficult, high uncertainty decisions. And then I think kind of, you know, seeing the positive outputs of kind of Lawrence writing Rapport and a book really aimed at the general population and translating our kind of psychology for a much larger audience, we kind of had a thought that a really nice idea would be to do the same thing with decision making. Because the more you talk about studying decision making with everyone in your life, the more they tell you they really need help making decisions and they wish they understood their own decisions. And so that kind of brought us, I think, to the point of writing Decision Time, which was, you know, this translational piece of all of these soldiers and police and fire and all these difficult decisions we'd studied and trying to use that to help, you know, people in their everyday lives with the decisions that they kind of focus on and struggle with.
Okay. So the type of decisions you're focusing on in this book are not everyday decisions. They're not like, what am I going to have for lunch? As you said, Neil, these are extreme decisions, like 1% of decisions people have to make. In the military, in the police, I can see the type of things that people have to make a decision, whether to engage with an enemy, shoot, not shoot. For an average person, what kind of decisions, extreme decisions, does a regular person have to face?
The book is written, there's lots of books about decision making, you know, and how to improve your life. But as Neil said, we've been dealing, in my case, the last 30 years, with people that make life-changing decisions. And although that is within military security services, law enforcement, and so on, nonetheless, we often find ourselves at a crossroads where we're making a really difficult life-changing decision. And it could be something as benign as what house will I buy? But that said, sometimes these decisions are really, really important and are really difficult that might be to do with whether to have cancer treatment or an end-of-life decision or something that is heavier, that is consequential, that is not reversible, that is high stakes, that does carry uncertainty and does carry risk. So they're the, I guess, less than 1% of decisions that we might face, but that are going to change our lives. And that's why we wrote the book.
Yeah, so okay, so they're, the stakes are high, a lot of uncertainty. Another characteristic of these decisions, oftentimes you just have to make that decision once in your entire life. And right. So you don't have any patterns to look back on how to make the decision because you haven't faced it before and you probably never will again.
I think one of the things that I'd add is so from when we were doing the original work with the soldiers, I remember talking to a kind of a VA clinician about the kind of decisions that we were specifically focusing on. And the way she phrased them, which I always really liked, was she called them kind of, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda decisions. And what made these decisions that we studied so tricky was that when the people made the decision, you could realistically see that both options could be good and both options could be bad. And very few decisions actually truly present in that way. And it makes them very difficult to make because even if you choose, you know, path A, it's very easy to convince yourself that path B also, you know, could have been as good. And I think when we look at our everyday decision-making and the decisions we make in our life, you know, it's not every decision that presents itself that way, but there are, as Lawrence said, you know, these life-changing, path-changing decisions we all face, maybe around taking a job, maybe around ending a relationship, maybe around moving country for love or career or whatever it may be. And if it's those decisions that both options could be really good or could be really bad, you've never had to make that calculation or that decision before, and there is that high uncertainty. You know, we've all experienced that, but as Lawrence said, it's a rarer form of decision, but the impact and potential of these decisions is so, so much higher. And then the other thing that makes choice so difficult, and from a psychological standpoint, is in order to choose one course of action, you necessarily have to sacrifice what the other course of action is offering you. And very few forms of decisions make you have to do that. And it's a specific form of decision making, but it is psychologically, I think, the most difficult because you have to sacrifice, you have to argue to yourself, and you're starting from a place of really not knowing whether A or B is the right choice or the right outcome for you.
You know, just to follow up on Neil's thing, just by way of giving an example, we talk about in the book, we compare, which might be a weird comparison, but we talk about the Thai cave rescue, where what Neil was saying is, if you take one course of action and you send a SEAL in to go and save the kids, once you've committed to that course of action, it could go wrong, but you're not going to know whether that goes wrong until you commit. And in the same way, it might seem a ridiculous comparison, but you know, if you've been in a relationship for many, many years and you decide to end that relationship, you can't then not end it. You can't have both pathways. You can't have your cake and eat it once you've made that commitment. those decisions that are irreversible are particularly difficult because you can't play out that parallel universe version of that decision that you didn't make or that choice that you didn't take and see whether it would have been better or worse. And that is what often causes hesitation. So one of the other things I want to emphasize is this, that often it's important to commit to what it is that you're going to do, because a lot of people spend their lives waiting and thinking, but not acting. So the other thing that this book touches on quite a lot is this thorny problem that we've seen a lot in emergency services, law enforcement, and so on, that they're not actually making erroneous decisions. They are failing to commit to a course of action. And, you know, you see this time and time again, whether it's a terrorist event or a disaster management thing. Organizations are often criticized for being slow to act or not acting at all, rather than making a really catastrophically bad decision. It's about pace, timing, and accuracy.
Yeah, I want to dig more into decision hesitation, decision inertia, because I thought that was really interesting. But before we do, in your experience, when you've looked at the research literature and also just in your own experience, when an organization or an individual faces one of these extreme decisions where it's super uncertain, you only have to make it once, the stakes are high, what's the typical decision pattern or method that people fall back onto, and why do they fall short?
Well, we've done quite a lot of work on the difference between novices and elite performers in this regard. And there are basically four mistakes that novices make that elite performers don't. The first, and actually all of these things are about proportionality and moderation. I mean, it's a bit like the rapport book where we were talking about anything that's extreme is usually bad. It's the same kind of principle here. And what we know that our elite performers do are, first of all, when they're trying to weigh up what it is they are dealing with and diagnose the actual problem itself, they will develop two or three plausible explanations for what's going on. Novices either develop one and stick to it and confirm everything in that one direction, or they develop a huge proliferation of possibilities and they can't juggle them in their mind. So proportionate development of three or four options to explain what's going on and then digging into them to decide which, you know, which best accounts for the situation. That's the first thing. The second thing is time management. Our elite performers are neither too slow nor too quick. They know they need to ask about time or consider time as a factor that they need to consider. And if they think that the window of opportunity is collapsing quickly, they will go with the best option that they can, given that time constraint. They also are able to calculate if they do have more time, and if you do, you should use it. If you've got more time to firm up a situation, you should use it. Novices either act too quickly or too slowly and often don't ask about time at all. The third thing is that our experts are able to adapt. So novices suffer from what we call entrainment. They will develop an idea, they will stick with that idea, and even in the face of compelling evidence to suggest they should change tack, they don't. Our experts are able to recognize and respond to those cues rapidly and change accordingly. And then the fourth thing is the ability to revise the plan, the ability to throw out the plan that was developed, that was right for then, but isn't right for now. So those are the four sort of mistakes people make. Too much faffing around trying to figure it out, not considering time at all, or just pondering forever, failing to adapt to the new circumstances and being unprepared to revise. Our elite performers don't do that. But I've got to say, our elite performers are rare. Why? Because if this is 1% of the times that you have to make a decision, as Neil said, you don't have that lexicon of experience behind you to be used to dealing with these novel or unique events.
Yeah, and I think most people, what they do when they face a tough decision, at least this is my method, is I'll go online and see, well, did someone else have this problem? Yep. And see how they made the decision. But like, it's kind of useful, but in the end, it's not, I usually find it not very useful because that person's situation is so unique that it's like, well, okay, this doesn't apply to me. Like I can't do anything with this.
Well, I think it's a really good point, and it's an interesting method, Brett. And I think it links to one of the points that we'll hopefully talk about throughout the interview. But one of the big things we emphasize about these forms of decisions is that they are often deeply personal, as in what the right decision is varies based on who the decision maker is. So to give you an example, you know, when we were writing the book, it was, you know, kind of at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. And one of the things that a lot of people were talking about was how, you know, young couples were handling the decision to get married or not get married or delay or do it by Zoom and all of these kind of things. And looking at that decision, I think, you know, you could look at what other people were doing. You could look at, were they doing it via Zoom? You could look at whether they were delaying 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it was. But to make that decision correctly, really, it's just what matters is what is right for you in that moment. And that's one of the things I think the book really emphasizes on is that it is always good to look at other people and think about maybe what other people have done. But at the end of the day, you know, what we preach is kind of this idea of, you know thyself. And so it really comes down to, I think, what makes you be able to make that decision is being able to look inside of yourself and know what truly matters to you, because it may be different to what these other people have done and how other people in the past have kind of made that decision in that moment.
Well, let's circle back to this idea of decision inertia. Why is it when we face these big decisions with high stakes, lots of uncertainty, that we typically don't do anything? Like, what's going on cognitively to cause that?
Well, what people tend to do is they go through a process that we call redundant deliberation. It's really weird, actually, because it's using a lot of cognitive effort for no gain. They will think about option B and think about all the permutations for option B. They will think about option A and all the permutations for option A, and they will just not be able to decide between the two because they don't want to commit. You know, they don't want to end that relationship. They don't want to have that cancer treatment because not having it could be better, or staying with the same person could be better. So they sort of, in perpetuity, just keep circling around and around these plausible options. So, I mean, my view that I use myself, two things that I ask myself that I think are useful when you're faced with these are, one, do I have to decide now? You know, you need to understand whether that decision is fast-paced or slow-paced. And if it is fast-paced, maybe you need to make a decision now. But most decisions aren't super fast. And so, therefore, you do need to slow things down and seek more information. But you can't put an infinite timeline on it. You have to put something that's proportionate. The second thing that I always ask myself is this: what is the goal? What do I want this to end up looking like? And, you know, we've found it with police before or even just everyday decisions. People get fixated on the decision, but not the end point, not the goal. What is it ultimately that you want out of this? And Neil, I don't know if you want to talk about your own personal experience with your wedding, because I know we went through it ourselves, but you know, there was a lot of debate. But when you articulated what the goal was, the decision presented itself easily. So I don't know if you want to give that example.
Well, I mean, I can, because I think it's interesting. So when we think about indecision, and I think one of the really interesting things about I mean, Lawrence's work historically on this and some of the things that we brought into the book is, you know, psychology is kind of the emphasis on stimulus response, and most of psychological research is set up to force the person to choose something and assess the choice that they made. So the idea of, I guess, studying the absence of a choice is actually quite psychologically odd. But one of the things that we see is it's really, really pervasive, and you see it, you know, in your everyday life. And there are different ways that people try and avoid decisions, from, you know, avoiding it completely to, you know, knowing what they want, but never, you know, as Lawrence mentioned earlier, never actually behaviorally committing to it. And it's a really easy pattern to fall into. And when I think about your question, Brett, you know, how do we kind of overcome it, and what kind of causes it? I think the thing that I always come back to, I think, is fear and courage being essential here. Because when you look at a true difficult decision, so, you know, what we would call a least worst decision that we kind of talk about in the book. So, you know, that they're all the examples we gave earlier: leaving relationships, changing jobs, moving countries, you know, divorces, how to have a marriage, all this kind of stuff, you know. Choosing something and committing to a course of action requires great courage, because you know that in doing so, you're actively losing something by choosing the choice that you've made. And so I will give the example that Lawrence gave that I think a lot of young couples faced in 2020, you know. So I was with my now wife, spoiler, I guess, to the decision we made, but we had that, you know, that horrible decision in May of 2020 of, do we get married, you know, via Zoom or some form of kind of stripped down, you know, COVID wedding, or do we delay and have, you know, the big 100 person, 150 person wedding that we'd spent, you know, 2 years planning. And we ended up choosing to get married via Zoom. And why I say that courage is so important is that when we made that choice, and so, you know, we knew that we were going to do it, you know, on the original date, just a few people, completely socially distanced, with no family coming, no friends flying over. You know, we knew that it was going to hurt. And you know that it is a difficult decision. And even though you know that you've chosen the right thing, you still have to have courage because you know that you've sacrificed things that are really, really important to you. And I think that's what really difficult choices require of you. They really require courage because you know that even if you think or know you're choosing something that's right, you're still losing something that mattered to you. And that's why these decisions are so difficult. And so I think when it comes to this idea of overcoming inertia, of committing to decisions and making them in the real world, you know, one of the things that Lawrence and I talk about a lot in the book is just the value of courage. And that's because, you know, fear of loss is such an innate human thing. We are designed to protect our resources. We hate the idea of loss. But a choice requires you to embrace loss and stare loss in the face, because whatever you do, whatever you choose, you will have to lose something. You will have to sacrifice something. And so it's this real balance, I think, of being brave enough to tolerate the loss in the knowledge that you are embracing the greater good or embracing the right choice for the right reasons.
No, I've in my own experience, the thing that causes me to put off decisions is that rumination trap that Lawrence was talking about. And like you said, it's really sneaky because it feels like you're doing something. It's like, I'm really thinking about this, but you're just going in circles over and over again. You have to decide, like, I got to make a decision. This is not doing anything. You have to catch yourself doing it and then just make the decision and move forward.
There's this kind of almost this curve of diminishing returns, right? And so we've planned this study recently where we kind of, you know, we get people to make a series of decisions, and we ask them if they want more information, right? And there are about 5 different information injects. And what's really interesting is some people say they want no information whatsoever, and they just dive right in. And that's not good. And then some people want all of the information, and eventually you have to kind of say, there's no more information. Just, you know, come on and do the decision. And the Goldilocks in this is someone kind of in the middle who takes some early information and really helps themselves understand the situation, invests a little bit of time, you know, early on, but then knows that anything more that they're getting now isn't really helping them. And now is the time to just kind of get out of that redundant deliberation and just move on to the kind of the making of the decision. And it's kind of something interesting. I think Lawrence, if you might want to talk about this from some of the work that we've done together, but we kind of identified this interesting kind of foxtrot pattern that kind of, you know, some of our better decision makers engaged in, which is where they kind of were, I think, what is it, like slow, slow, quick, quick? My dancing knowledge might be a little off.
Yes, slow, slow, quick, quick. Slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, actually.
Okay. So what this was is we were doing a study with military or police, I think it was, and looking at the different patterns that people use to make decisions. And what we found was there was this one pattern that people engaged in, which was kind of fast, fast, slow, slow, which was that they moved through the information gathering stage really, really quickly. But then they got really stuck on the actual process of having to choose between the options. And then there was this kind of more, I think it was the more senior officers who actually demonstrated this pattern, which was kind of this idea of this slow, slow, quick, quick, which was that they took more time to gather the information. They took a bit more time to comprehend the situation. And then when it came to making the decision, they were much faster to be able to choose what the right option to them was.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today.
If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, cleanup's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And now back to the show. You devote a chapter, and you mentioned it early on, about if you want to make better decisions, you have to know thyself. How does greater self-awareness improve decision-making? Like what do we need to know about ourselves in order to make better decisions?
Well, we're certainly one of the things that we're repeatedly finding is that there's this attribute called maximization or minimization, which in really simple terms is, if you tend to be a maximizer, you're the sort of person that wants everything to work out really well. So you find it very hard to tolerate a poor outcome, or even an outcome where there's two options, both of them look bad, and you're not really prepared to even pick the least bad one. So there's really bad and bad, but you just don't want the bad one. And people that are maximizers, we tend to find, suffer more from this kind of redundant deliberation or constant rumination, because they're thinking, you know, basically feeling regretful about a future scenario that they find intolerable. Whereas minimizers, which is the kind of alternative sort of thinking approach, is, okay, this is not ideal, but I'd rather have this least bad option than the really bad one. So part of this is knowing whether you're a minimizer or a maximizer. And they're not necessarily one better than the other, but if you score very high on maximization, you tend to be the sort of person that will ruminate in perpetuity. So that's one function. The other thing that we know quite a lot about is a thing called need for closure. And in simple terms, the idea of that is, if you are the sort of person that requires a lot of predictability, certainty, order, decisiveness, you know, you want to know exactly what time you're going to meet at the restaurant, how many people are going to be there, what's going to be on the menu, da-da-da-da-da-da. That type of thing can slow people down as well. So people that can tolerate ambiguity, which is the opposite of need for closure, tend to be faster time decision makers. So, I mean, but the broad concept about knowing thyself, and I think Neil spoke about this earlier, is knowing what your value system is, you know, where you want to stack your tokens, what matters to you most, and having good insight into that and being able to articulate that and face yourself in the mirror and think about it will help you identify the absolute critical function of decision making, which is what is my goal? Where do I want to end up? What am I prepared to sacrifice and what I'm not? And Neil, you know, did a lot of work on what we call sacred and secular values. So just a little segue on that. Where you have a sacred value, it's something which is non-negotiable. So if we talk about military sacred values, you might have a sacred value of leave no man behind. A secular value is something that you'd like to retain but isn't critical and might be negotiable. But where you have a problem is where two sacred values collide. So in military ops, we found that if you've got the sacred value of leave no man behind and complete the mission, and we design a scenario which has both of those colliding, that's where you find it difficult to tease those two things apart. So sacred values are the ones that are really tricky to negotiate. One other thing I just want to add about the Foxtrot thinking, which I think is interesting, and to just reinforce this point for listeners, stacking your tokens at the front end of the thinking is a good idea. To think about what it is that you are dealing with carefully and diagnose what you're dealing with is really important. That then enables you to speed up.
Well, yeah, Lawrence, we talked about this, the sacred secular problem in our conversation about Hercules. Mm-hmm. Hercules faced some decisions where he had sacred values in conflict with each other, and it made decisions tough.
Yeah. So I think without segueing into the Hercules thing, we had that exact situation, didn't we? Where, you know, he left one of his compadres behind after a scrap, and that was a difficult thing to do. It kind of ruined him and created a degree of moral injury, and that's not uncommon in soldier scenarios. But Neil may have something to say about this as well.
Well, no, I think it's all tethered to the idea of kind of knowing thyself. And so the one thing that I've heard most of the feedback I've had from the book, from family member and friends, is they call me and they say, oh, you wouldn't believe it, you know, I'm a maximizer. And I'm like, well, yes, objectively, I probably could have told you that. And, you know, they always say, well, it's a bad thing. And I was, it's not a bad thing. Being a maximizer isn't a bad thing. But knowing yourself means that you know what your miss is going to be. And so what we talk about in the decision-making is that, you know, there are times to be a maximizer. And there are times when you really can't maximize. And what you want to avoid is the attempt to maximize in a non or unmaximizable situation. Right? And so I think it's really kind of one of the important things that knowing thyself means is kind of, you know, the pattern you're going to fall into. You know what your personality trait is and what you're going to want from a decision. And sometimes it's about knowing that the decision that you're facing just isn't going to let you have everything, and accepting that and being able to move on. And I think that links to what Lawrence was just saying, this kind of the second part of knowing thyself, which is literally about, you know, knowing thy values. And one of the formative books as we were writing the original book, we wrote a book called Conflict, How Soldiers Make Impossible Decisions, which kind of was our platform for writing Decision Time, was Mark Monson's book, you know, The Subtle Art. Basically, the art to a happy life, or the art to happy living, is knowing the one thing that you care about so much that you're willing to sacrifice everything else. And that, I think, has always been our kind of framework of knowing thyself and this discussion of sacred values is looking at a decision and knowing the one value, if you can, the one value that absolutely matters more to you than anything else. And it's really difficult to do. And, you know, we give examples in the book from people that we've met and people that we've worked with. And, you know, we have friends who we've watched face these kind of decisions. You know, you're given this brand new promotion or this brand new job opportunity, and it's really important to you that, you know, you chase your career and you have value in your work and you achieve everything you can, but that's running directly against something else that might be, you know, investment in the family and spending time with your young children and your wife as they grow up and they do these foundational moments of taking their first steps, saying their first words. And what a good decision maker has to be able to do is to sit there and work out, I have two values going against each other, and whatever choice I make, I'm going to run over one of those values. So which one can I absolutely not sacrifice in any way? Is it, you know, myself, my career, my confidence and my identity, or is it me as a family member, me as a father, me as a, you know, contributing to the household. And if people aren't able to know thyself and know that value, then and links back to the, you know, the Heracles, you know, example that Lawrence gave in your prior podcast of you know, you actually risk this idea of moral injuries. You know, when you make a decision that sacrifices something that's truly, truly important to you, that's a specific form of trauma that you can have, you know, from making the wrong decision in a crucial moment. And so all of our model of decision-making, it's all based on first and foremost, knowing who you are, knowing your patterns and your tendencies and your psychology, and then knowing, really being able to work out what actually matters to you when it comes to making this decision, you know, whether it's the goals or the values.
Well, let's move on and talk about your decision-making model. It's called STAR. It's an acronym. And the S in STAR stands for situational awareness or storytelling. What's involved in developing good situational awareness? I mean, any questions people should be asking when they're faced a decision, they're trying to get their bearings on the situation?
So when it comes to situational awareness, I guess there are kind of, you know, the original model is that there are kind of three stages of situational awareness, right? Which is kind of identifying, you know, the patterns in the environment or cues in the environment that matter, webbing them together to kind of get an understanding of what's going on. And then this third layer is kind of using that to project, you know, what will happen if you do action A or do action B. And as Lawrence kind of mentioned earlier, the thing about situational awareness is it's about not just going all in, originally just going all in on this one assessment of the situation, having adaptability and the flexibility to think about what are the other factors that could be going on? What are the different interpretations of this situation? And we talk about in the book, one of these early trainings that Lawrence gave, and I think at the time I was kind of helping alongside, but we gave this early training to police officers, kind of, you know, policing the tube during the, I think it was the 2012 or 2014 Olympics in London. And what we talked to them about was this idea of, you know, when you're stressed, when you're tired, when you're hot, when you've got all of these things going on, you know, you're running out of resources, and the natural pattern is to think you know what's going on, to not test it, to not think of alternatives, and just to basically just go all in on this, you know, this one assessment of the situation. And I think kind of in the S model of our STAR, what we really preach about is being open and flexible to thinking or holding in your mind, are there two or three potential explanations for this situation, potential interpretations of what I'm seeing in front of me and what this means. And you know, the extreme of that is something that, you know, Lawrence and I have talked about, and we recently put a paper out about, you know, the best decision makers are, you know, when they have to be, they're kind of grim storytellers. They have imagination, you know, they're really able to think critically about what their situation is. And so with the S stage of the model, it's finding a calibration between these two extremes that Lawrence mentioned earlier, right? The first extreme is just seeing something, thinking you know exactly what's going on, and diving right in with this kind of singular interpretation of the situation. This has happened, and I think it's going to be this. On the very, very other end is not really knowing or committing to any kind of interpretation, and just thinking that, well, there are 100 things that could explain this, and I can't really move forward because I don't really know possibly what anything that's going on in this situation. And in the middle, there's this kind of sweet spot of being able to identify a few plausible explanations and taking the time to kind of game those explanations against each other to really get the best understanding of the situation that you can, because everything about a decision stems from what you actually think is going on and how you're interpreting kind of the information that's in front of you.
The key takeaways from that, I think, are don't over ruminate about every possibility. You know, conjure in your head two or three possibilities and make sure that one of them, which I know is a bit unpleasant, but one of them should be, what's the worst case scenario here? What is the, you know, if I think this is going on, okay, I don't really want to go there and think it's maybe this bad, but you know what? Perhaps I do need to think it's maybe this bad, because then the shock of it being that reality is less damning and you are prepared to deal with it. So simple takeaways, think about what it is you're dealing with. Have no more than three. I mean, that's a bit of a rule of thumb, but it's hard to have in your mind more than kind of three possible situational models about what you're dealing with. Make sure one of them is the worst possible scenario.
Okay. And what's interesting that all of this, like you're admitting that you don't know what the situation is exactly because you have three different options.
Yeah. So you are alive to the possibility that there are three ways to explain what it is that you're seeing. So say you want to end a relationship or I think we talk about a mastectomy there, you know, whether you're going to have your breasts removed in relation to cancer. You want to sort of think about, what does this look like? What's the worst case scenario? What do I value? Maybe this could happen, and this could happen. Three options: best case scenario, worst case scenario, somewhere in between. But don't ruminate on that forever. At that point, it gives you some kind of idea about how much, you know, what work you need to do to disentangle whether it's more likely to be one, two, or three. In the same way that perhaps someone that's dealing with an illness is going to be looking at it. You know, someone comes to the doctor and they present with various symptoms. That doctor should be thinking, well, this could be this bad. It could be cancer, and therefore, what do we need to do to firm up whether it is? What tests do we need to do that? However, it could be something benign, and that's a plausible scenario as well. And it's at that stage that you should seek to interrogate information that will help you push forward one of those three scenarios more than the other. But like I say, you know, when you're considering these existential pathways, you do have to contemplate the worst case scenario. It gives you much more stretch in your imagination to be able to deal with what is going to eventually be coming at you.
All right. So the next part in the STAR model, T, stands for time mastery. Why is when we make a decision important? And then what happens if your timing is off?
Because if it's imminent and the decisions move past you, you're knackered, basically. I mean, it does surprise me how often people don't even consider time. I mean, our really poor decision makers don't even ask about it. They don't think, well, do I have to decide now? How much time have I got? They just think they've got all the time in the world. And, you know, for most of us, most of the time, happily, we do have a bit of time to think about a decision. I mean, you know, in military situations, that isn't always the case. But sometimes even in our own lives, there is a time limit on which we should really. I mean, I've spoken to countless people, police officers, that have stayed in the same job for years. And for, you know, every year they're saying, I kind of feel a bit burnt out with this job and maybe I should change and I'm not giving enough time to my family. What do you think? And then we'll go through all the possible scenarios that they could do, and maybe they could change this or they could change to another unit, blah, blah. And then they'll come back a month later, same thing. And again, and again, and again. And if you don't have that externally imposed time pressure on you with a shoot, no shoot decision, you can just keep extending that deadline forever. So ask, do I have to decide now? More often than not, you don't have to decide imminently. But if you don't have to decide imminently, then you need to start thinking about what is a reasonable amount of time to allocate to this decision. And a pretty good tip to tell you that you have now run out of time is if you keep asking the same questions and you keep getting the same information, then you really don't want to be waiting a lot longer because there is no new information. And you do now need to decide.
What happens if you have to make a decision now? Is there a heuristic that people can use to know like what's the right thing to do or the best thing to do in that situation?
Very simple terms, least, worst, first. This is bad. This is awful. Let's go with bad.
If there's a huge time pressure and you absolutely have to make a decision right now, and you honestly are staring at two or three horrible or bad options, the only thing to be able to do is really say to yourself, what is the one option that I, or the one miss that I cannot tolerate? And that's that kind of that, if you can do it, that's that kind of sacred value. And under time pressure, that may be the only thing you have time to try and reflect on or calculate.
Okay, so the next part of STAR is A, and that's adaptation. What do you guys mean by that?
Well, I think adaptations are really critical stage, because I think it kind of links a little bit to the first stage, which is situational awareness. But there's some old psychology in kind of the 1990s on NASA. I think it's NASA errors, and it found that most of the bad decisions or error based decisions in this pilot sample was not because they didn't understand what was going on. It's because they understood what was going on, then the environment changed and they were unable to update or reevaluate what was going on when new information was coming in. And so I think one of the things about kind of when we look at these decisions in the real world and these kind of, you know, these complicated decisions that people are facing, you know, they're iterative, they're moving moments in time. And so sometimes the scene does change and sometimes the situation does change. And what we often see is that people fail to adapt and update their way of thinking. And there's a lot of, you know, I think this links, probably the point of the book that I think links to a lot of the, you know, the core psychology around decision makers is driven by heuristics and biases and cognitive closure. And the fact that the, you know, we are cognitive misers in the sense that we're always trying to confirm what we currently think is correct anyway, because it's easier than having to re-update and re-evaluate and reconsider what we think we're staring at. And so the adaptation phase is encouraging people that even if you've made the best assessment of the situation you can, and even if you have, you know, understood your relationship with time and when a decision needs to be made, and assuming that you haven't, you know, missed the decision window, you know, be open to updating your assessment of what's going on. Be open to new information. You know, be willing to ask if things on the ground have changed, if your current understanding is no longer in date and needs to be updated. And it's just an exercise in almost good cognition, you know, good cognitive healthy behavior to reevaluate, reupdate, reintegrate, and just to check that what you think is going on and assessed is going on is still there. And it's really difficult. So, you know, one of the examples we have in the book is this interesting case of this guy, Jack, who, you know, he's offered this job out of the blue. And it's kind of a shiny new job with a shiny new promotion. And if anyone's ever been offered a job or offered, you know, an opportunity, suddenly the way you evaluate the current job, you know, you're almost looking for the negatives now. You know, you've been offered this shiny new thing and, you know, it changes the way you look at everything around you, right? And that's the brain, that's the mind trying to make the decision easier by stripping away uncertainty and just closing itself off to, you know, any alternative way of thinking. So when we make decisions, our cognitive structure is sometimes working against us to make things simpler. And so adaptation in dynamic and difficult decisions is absolutely essential because people need to keep checking that their assumptions are correct. Keep checking the situation is what they think it is. Is there anything new? Is there anything different? Is there a bit of information that really needs me to think differently, that something else is actually going on here, that something has changed since I started trying to work through this decision? And, you know, it's just one of those critical stages that, you know, we often don't see in that. That old research has found it, our own research has found it, that, yeah, you know, people really need to focus on being adaptive and making sure that their assessment is always in time with kind of, you know, what they're facing.
So the final part of STAR is R, and that stands for revision and resilience. And this can be a really hard part because often our tendency is after we've made a decision, we've taken action, and we're doing it, even though we get new information and we see like, oh, we should probably adapt, it's really hard to go back on your decision. You're like, well, I made the decision, I got to stick with it. So how do you figure out whether or not you should stick with a decision or you should bail and change your mind and do something else?
I mean, well, it's a really interesting conundrum. And again, I think it speaks to just the way, just the ethos of the kind of psychology we talk about in the book. And Lawrence mentioned it earlier. I think, you know, nothing is good in extremes. And so in the resilience chapter and revision, you know, we really talk about this idea of you know, of change in its extremes, right? And so one extreme of change is someone who, the minute they face a difficulty, the minute they face a hardship, abandons course and immediately, you know, goes to find a new course of action and decides that their plan is a failure. And you know, in psychology, there's a lot of, you know, theories and research on, you know, things like grit. So Angela Duckworth, you know, her idea of grit is this kind of this golden trait that predicts success is people's ability to be gritty and work through things. And, you know, we talk about, you know, desirable difficulties as, you know, being able to work through difficult moments and difficult decisions often require difficult moments, you know. So the wedding example I gave earlier, you know, after making the decision, there were difficulties, you know, in telling people what your choice is, you know, there's difficulties. And if you change a job, it's not immediately amazing sometimes. And in the first 6 to 12 months, there's difficulties. You know, if you leave a relationship, there's difficulties, right? And so there's this psychological idea that, you know, you have to work through those. And that's, you know, that's critical to success. And it is. And then on the other side, there's another organizational psychologist who kind of studied this idea of persistence and identified this really interesting part of persistence called inappropriate persistence, which is kind of this idea of just persisting for the sake of persisting because you just want to persist, right? Which is almost like the complete opposite end of the spectrum. And you're not persisting for a reason. You're not persisting for a purpose. You're merely persisting because you don't want to not persist at something. And again, that extreme of non-revision is equally detrimental and equally harmful. You know, if you change jobs and you move countries and 2 years in, you hate it and you still are unhappy and still nothing is going correct, maybe there's a point to reevaluating and coming home. And so it comes down to the question that you asked, Brett, which, you know, how do you juggle and how do you know what the right balance of those two polar ends of the scale are? And I think it comes back to, in the way that we kind of talked about it in the book, is knowing why you're persisting, right? So when you're experiencing a difficulty, a desirable difficulty or otherwise, why are you being gritty? What are you persisting in purpose of, or in the quest for? And I think it comes back to that idea of, are you persisting for something that is sacred, that is important, that means something to you? Are you persisting in line with your values and your goals? And if you're not, and you just find yourself persisting because of a fear of non-persisting, well, then you may be in that state that you're no longer being driven by the right motives and by the right motivations.
So it all goes back to knowing thyself.
I think it really does. And I think, you know, I think the more that we talk about the book, and the more that we, you know, the more that we hear from, you know, the readers that have, you know, been very kind to, you know, share their thoughts on it with us. That's what I think it comes down to from one of the big parts, I think, when we wrote it and what people are reading from it, is the value of knowing thyself. And it's difficult because I think, especially if you're young and, you know, you're thinking about your values, you know, values change. You know, knowing yourself, the personality may be slightly more rigid, but things that are sacred to you, that matter to you, that are really important to you, they change. And it's almost like working out. It's something that you do need to consciously often think about what matters to you, reflect on it, update what is actually sacred and important to me. And Lawrence and I, we had a long walk on the beach a few weeks ago where we talked about our values and our goals. And it's interesting that I have kind of, you know, as I've grown up, I'm experiencing, you know, sacred value shifts in real time. And you can't make a good decision unless you know what the most important thing to you is. Because, you know, the real risk here, I think, you know, the one of the risks is not making a decision. But the other risk is making a decision driven by a value that you think is the sacred one and finding out after you've made the decision that it really isn't. And that's not a state I think we'd wish on anyone, and something that, you know, really this book is aimed at trying to help people avoid. So while I think the STAR model is critical, because I think it really talks about what I think real life difficult decisions look like, we can't take away from just the importance of knowing who you are and what really matters to you when you're kind of looking at making these kind of, you know, fork in the road, you know, life-changing decisions.
Well, Lawrence Neal, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
The book is currently available on amazon.co.uk and on Audible. And for any American listeners, I believe in about a few months, it will be out for the stateside audience. And any of our work on kind of the operational side of things, so training with police, military, law enforcement, we have our Ground Truth website, which Lawrence can correct me if I get it wrong. It's ground-truth.co.uk, but that's where we kind of, you know, work with all of the practitioners on our decision-making trainings and our rapport trainings and any of that, or our Twitter feeds if you, I guess, want to see our opinions on, current events.
Fantastic. Well, Lawrence Neal, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brett. Thank you
very much. Brett, great to speak to you.
My guests today were Lawrence Allison and Neal Shortland. They're the authors of the book Decision Time. It's available on Amazon.com. Make sure to check out our show notes at aom.is/decisiontime, where you can find links to resources where you delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Make sure to check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles written over the years about pretty much anything you think of. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family Premium member who think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, it's Brett McKay. Remind you to not listen to the AON podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Hey, this is Jeff Lewis from Radio Andy. Live and uncensored, catch me talking with my friends about my latest obsessions, relationship issues, and bodily ailments. With that kind of drama that seems to follow me, you never know what's going to happen.
You can listen to Jeff Lewis live at home or anywhere you are. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.